You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa and beyond. Grassroots, listener-supported, solar-powered radio broadcasting live from the snowy cultural district here in Fairfield, Iowa. This is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn. And I just wanted to note that if you just listen to the Filmosophers, which is the show right before us, Bruce asked me to say that that was recorded, and it was recorded ahead of time, and he got the date. The documentary that he talked about right at the end at the Fairfield Public Library was actually last week. It's already over, so don't go showing up there expecting it tonight.
Oh, that's too bad.
So, anyway, let's get down to the business of Writer's Voices today. Mom, how are you?
Oh, I'm good. At least it's not blizzarding here.
That is true. That is true.
So we're doing okay.
Now, our topic today is something that you have some experience with.
Yes, education, indeed. Yep. Indeed. And this gentleman is amazing because, and of course, being a musician, I appreciate it even more because he incorporated music into the whole education thing. Paul Cummins, renowned educator and founder, CEO, and president of the Coalition for Engaged Education, formerly New Visions Foundation, is committed to creating opportunities for all children to have equitable access to a quality education, which is very important. He has founded and co-founded numerous schools, including Crossroads School, New Road School, Camino Nuevo Charter School, and New Village Charter School, as well as PS Arts and NPO, providing art classes to children in Title I schools. He has published 4 books on education, a biography, 2 volumes of his original poetry, my goodness, and 2 children's books. His forthcoming book entitled Engaged Education, New Visions for Joy and Success in Learning. And this is a memoir. It's Confessions of a Headmaster. Oh, boy.
Welcome to Writer's Voices, Paul.
Thank you very much. State.
What part of Iowa?
Des Moines.
Well, that's not too far from Mom's birthplace in Newton, Iowa. I was actually born in California.
Oh, wow. Well, so we have some connections here.
Yes, absolutely. Northern California, though. You've spent most of your life, I believe, in Southern California?
Most of my life in Los Angeles. I grew up in Fort Wayne, Indiana, until I was about 8 years old, and then my father moved us all out here. So I've been out here for 70 years, which gives away my age.
Yes, it does, at least for those of us who still have some math skills.
Right.
So, Paul, what does a headmaster really need to confess?
Well,
good question.
You know, I've had a whole bunch of different titles for the book, and my publisher, Red Hand Press, thought that was kind of a catchy title that might get people to open the book or purchase it or whatever. I'm afraid the title, you know, suggests maybe a little more than the book provides, but everybody who's read it so far that talks to me seem to like it. So the confessions are really, I guess I address kind of 3 questions that people find themselves interested in once they get into the book. So there's nothing salacious about it, no sleeping with your faculty or anything like that. But how does a young man from a family that was not terribly intellectual go off to college and become a scholar, number one. Number two, how do you start a school? And so some of the confessions are some of the early challenges and early problems and early crises that I encountered in launching my first school, which was Crossroads School. And then I guess a third area of interest to some people is, well, Paul, now that you've been in education for over 50 years, what do you think are some of the solutions to the problems that our schools are facing today? So there's kind of 3 questions that maybe jump out at people. One is the sort of biographical question of how did you go come out of this sort of intellectual wasteland of both your high school and your family. I love my parents, but they were not intellectuals. And how then do you start a school? And then what's wrong with American schools?
Yeah, and that's a big that's a big subject.
You know, sort of a mouthful and
it
a handful.
Is,
and,
it is, and this is not that long a book.
Kind of addresses all three of those issues, and so we, however you want to go is fine, but those are three areas that we could explore.
Absolutely. Now, Paul, it sounds like you aren't anywhere near retiring.
No, I'm not. My college roommate, who retired a number of years ago, thinks I'm crazy, and he says, you know, you've got a nice little retirement program set up for yourself. Why don't you retire? And I think, well, I mean, I don't want to put him down for his retirement, but I think, what am I going to do? I'm going to wake up in the morning and read the New York Times until noon, have lunch, take a nap, and, you know, do some pleasure reading, have dinner, and watch TV and go to bed. I'm much more excited about what I'm doing now, and in fact, I just came from a meeting last night where a friend of mine and I finalized a deal on a campus for a brand new school that we hope to launch next September.
Oh my gosh.
And a breakfast meeting this morning with a guy who can help us with the marketing, and then a phone conference call this afternoon with a group of people, which I've joined the board of, and we're starting a school in August in Pine Ridge, South Dakota, on a Native American reservation in a high poverty, highly depressed area. So those two projects to me are a lot more exciting than just sort of sitting around and kind of having a nice leisurely retirement.
Wow, so you're still starting schools.
Yeah, I guess that's sort of, I don't know if it's my destiny or it's something it's kind of a skill that not everybody has, so you may as well keep doing what you know how to do.
Now, when you like these new schools, are they both geographically distant from the schools that you've already started?
Yeah, well, the one here in Los Angeles is, we're going to call it Tree Academy, T-R-E-E, and it's a little bit further east in Los Angeles than the two West Side schools that I've started, but it's kind of on the border between people who have money and people who don't. And the goal of the school is to attract both. So it's to have not only a racial diversity, but an economic, socioeconomic diversity, and bring kids from all different backgrounds, including international, together, because the world is not all white and wealthy, and the world is a wonderfully diverse rainbow of different backgrounds, and we want our school to reflect that. The school in Pine Ridge will be all Native American girls, and we're kind of responding to a crisis there where a group of Native Americans on the reservation and a group of interested people here in Southern California are responding to, this is such a high poverty area. There have been some articles that you may have seen in the New York Times and various other places about kind of an epidemic of suicides there among young girls. Girls who are actually 12, 13, 14-year-olds who are hanging themselves, which is really astonishing. So we're going to try and start a really quality private school there and see if we can give these girls a sense that they do have a future and that there's hope for a better life.
Paul, if somebody wanted to support this effort, is there a way that they can do that?
Yes. Well, they could contact me, for example, at my organization, Coalition for Engaged Education, and we're online, and so people could just contact me directly. I think the school is now online. It's going to be called Pine Ridge Girls School, and so there are ways. The easiest way, I think, would be to contact me, and then I'll put whoever that is in touch with the appropriate people.
What I'll do when I post your interview on writersvoices.com, I'll put a link to your website, too, to make it easy
Terrific.
For people to find
Perfect.
You.
Perfect. I'm kind of a techno. my daughters call me Neanderthal, but so if you know how to do that, great.
Paul, how do you convince the wealthy white parents that it's to their kids' advantage to be in a diverse school environment?
Well, generally speaking, I don't have to convince the people that come to the projects that I'm advertising, marketing associated with, because I've been around Los Angeles now for over 50 years doing what I'm doing. And so any project that I'm involved with now, people kind of know that diversity is part of the game. So if you're looking for a really nice, white, elitist, safe, private school, then you're probably not going to seek me out anyhow. But if there's a parent who kind of stumbles across one of these projects, then they tend to be pretty responsive to the notion that that the planet is shrinking, and it's pretty hard now to wall yourself out, even though some people want to wall ourselves in and wall other people out. But the world now is pretty interdependent, and we're going to sink together or we're going to swim together. And so people, when you start having that conversation, people tend to start nodding their heads in agreement, even though maybe no one has really, in education, brought that to their attention.
Wow. Now, this has been sort of part of your mission from the very beginning, too.
It has, but it's been growing and growing. And the more that the longer I stay in education, the more concerned I am with this growing disparity between not only the haves and the have-nots economically, but how that translates out educationally. So the school that I first started, Crossroads School, the tuition there this year is a little over $37,000.
Whoa!
That's virtually what they're spending per pupil. And the Los Angeles public schools are spending ballpark $10,000 per pupil. I'm not sure what it is in Iowa right now, but it's probably somewhere around there. So that my old school, I mean, I'm not there anymore, but Crossroads School, is spending almost four times as much money per pupil as inner city public schools are. And of course, with $37,000 per pupil, you can provide a whole lot more program and a whole lot better teaching conditions than you can if you're spending $10,000 per pupil. And so that's in my new book that has been accepted for publication by Red Hen Press. They've got now my next to final draft. They'll do some editing. But I've got a chapter called The Elephant in the Room, or The Big Elephant in the Room. And the elephant in the room is funding. And I find everywhere I go, people don't really want to talk about that. But it's a big, big issue. And, you know, the kids that go to good suburban public schools where there is a higher per pupil spending and where the parents can afford to go out and raise more money for the school, and then the private schools around the country, you're getting a very different education there than you're getting in inner city, barrio, ghetto schools. It just, and to me, it's not fair. It's the way the world is. I don't know if you saw, but the New York Times published an article 2 days ago of a report that Oxfam put out.
I saw a headline.
Did you see that?
Yeah.
It was just startling.
What did it say?
Well, the statistic that hits you right between the eyes is that 62 people around the planet, 62 individuals, their combined wealth equals that of 3.5 billion people, namely half of humanity, half of the planet. 62 equals 3.5 billion. Now, that's a really peculiar way to organize your planet.
Isn't it?
Don't you think?
Yeah.
And you see, that translates out into education. And obviously, the children of the 62 and the top 1% around the planet get a superb education, and the 3.5 billion poorest people don't, generally speaking, get a very good education. So they're kind of doomed when they're born.
You know, I never did understand how public schools, why you spend more in a rich area per student than in a poor area. It ought to be the other way around, because...
Well, it's tied in many places with property.
I know, but the wealthier
parents... And
then
it's also tied in with the ability of the parents to go beyond what they get from the state. They don't get no public school gets very much money from the federal government. But the state's ability to spend per pupil is dramatically different. I think New Jersey is something like $18,000 per pupil, and Utah's is around $5,000 per pupil.
Wow.
And Mississippi and New Mexico and various states like that just don't have very much money to spend per pupil. And consequently, the kids don't get nearly as diverse a curriculum and as rich a program, and they don't get the teaching conditions. There are schools here in Los Angeles where if you're a classroom teacher, you have five classes a day of anywhere between 40 and 50 kids per
class. Oh, my gosh.
Whoa.
My God, how can you teach in conditions like that?
You can't.
Well, what I'm wondering is, if at $10,000 per student, where's the money going? If the class sizes are that large, it's not going to the teachers.
Well, and, I mean, it's different states have different problems they have to deal with. But LAUSD, for example, there's a huge benefits package that the teachers get. Some of the money goes into facilities. There was such an influx of immigrant children into Los Angeles public schools that they had to go out and build a whole bunch of new schools fairly quickly. The teacher salaries are fairly decent. Their benefit package is really almost crazy. It's so good. So the money goes into different places, but and there's a big bureaucracy in many public school districts that sucks up a lot of money that should be going into the classroom.
I mean, there's funding, but then there's also making the most of the money that you have, and I think you have to take both angles to improve education.
Yes, so I'm not here to say that we can solve all of the problems of public schools by spending more money, but I am saying that if we don't, there's a whole lot of problems we can't fix.
Right, and not spending the money on educating, particularly people from impoverished backgrounds, you spend it as a society. We spend it another way. We spend it later, and we spend it in ways that are not nearly as productive.
I agree completely. Mm-hmm. But it's a hard conversation to have because you very quickly slide over into politics.
Yeah.
Which I will try to avoid on this call. But there are when I bring up the issue of that we need to spend more money on public education, then I get from certain quarters two huge arguments right away. Well, we're already spending too much, or well, then you just want to raise taxes, don't you? Mm-hmm. And both of those are almost conversation killers.
Now, Paul, I will let you know this is Iowa and caucus season, so it's pretty hard to avoid politics around here.
I know that. That's why I'm trying not to. I'm trying not to let my political slip show.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Paul F. Cummins, author of Confessions of a Headmaster. Well, Paul, let's go back to, at what point in your life did you know that education was your passion, and that's how you wanted to spend your life?
Well, that's a nice question, and I always kind of take a little bit of pride in answering the question. I grew up in a nice, wealthy neighborhood with lovely, loving parents, and went to a private school that wasn't terribly exciting at that time. So I went off to college, not much of a scholar, and went off to college thinking I was going to play football and then go into my father's business and so on. And very rapidly in college, I met a fellow student who decided that I was pretty dumb and he was going to make a project out of out of educating me. And I kind of liked him, so I went along with it. He started feeding me books, and I started enjoying them. And then I had a Western Civ teacher, which was a required class at Stanford, and he took a different tack. He just went after me and kept pointing out on a daily basis. I had him for three quarters how uneducated I was, and instead of that depressing and defeating me, I took it as a challenge that I wanted to show him that I wasn't dumb, which was pretty hard to do because I was pretty dumb at the time. So I just started reading, and I wanted to show these two people that maybe I could learn, and so that was the start of it. And then I started, as the more I got excited about reading and learning and thinking and learning about the world's issues, which I didn't know about, I started thinking about my own high school. And then I started asking myself the question, well, why am I excited about learning now? And I wasn't only a couple years ago. Surely I was ready a couple years ago. And so I started thinking about, well, what I wished my high school had been like. And then I had one of these, what they call aha moments. I was in my junior year at Stanford. I was sitting in a big lecture hall, and I kind of zoned out. I wasn't hearing the lecture. I was scribbling frantically in a notebook, and I was off kind of in a zone. And when the bell rang and ended the period, I looked at what I had been writing, and it was I had been outlining a curriculum for the school, the high school that I wished I had gone to. And I looked at it, and I thought, boy, there's a voice telling me that maybe you want to go into education. And I called my father that night and told him I was thinking of going into teaching rather than coming home and running the family business, which, as it turned out, was probably a good idea because a year later my father's business went in the tank. So there would have been no business to come home to, number one. But number two, by then I had really fallen in love with learning. So I went off to graduate school, Harvard Graduate School of Education, and got even more excited, had some wonderful teachers there, and then came back and started teaching.
Now, being a teacher,
I guess, like all of us, you know, probably the two of you, when you look back on your own education, probably there's a teacher or two or three back in there that had a big impact on you. And everybody I ever talked to say, oh, yeah, Miss So-and-so in the third grade, or Mr. Jones in the 10th grade, or my freshman English teacher, or whatever. But we've all had those teachers. And that kind of got me excited, too, when I realized that I now had a couple teachers that were really changing my life. And so it seemed like an exciting thing to do. And then also because I had fallen in love with reading and writing, I thought, well, how can I get paid to keep doing this? And teaching seemed like the obvious, you know, obvious route to go.
Now, Mom also was a teacher.
Yes.
What grade?
Well, I started out teaching as an aide at the high school for slow readers. And then, there was a lot of them. And then I went back to school and got my degree. And I taught 7th and 9th grade at the junior high. And then I moved to the high school and taught 10 through 12.
She taught English and sociology.
Yeah.
The gamut, pretty much.
Right. But I'll tell you, one of the
middle school, as you mentioned, boy, that's such a crucial age.
Oh,
where
I know.
So many kids start falling apart.
Yeah. It was funny with the 7th graders, you know, the teacher was still God, the first 2 weeks, you know,
and then they start getting difficult in the 8th grade. I taught 8th grade 1 year, and I found I didn't relate to them very well. I went into the headmaster of my private school at the time, and I said, "Get me out of the 8th grade. I want to teach seniors." So he did, and I had a ball teaching 12th grade English for a number of years.
Yeah, junior high is a very challenging age. Now, some teachers that I've known love it. You know, they just love
absolutely.
That age.
Absolutely. There are teachers who somehow seem to have a kind of understanding and sympathy and compassion for the beginning onset of adolescence, and they seem to know how to deal with them. I didn't have that ability.
Yeah, I don't think I would have either. So, Mom, do you have some stories of people coming back later?
How did you know I was thinking about that?
Yeah.
one of the best things that happened to me was I used to put on the board every day a sentence that was grammatically incorrect, and then they were to correct it, and we would talk about it. And so, you know, several years later, I met this kid in the grocery store when I'd moved to a different town, actually, and He stopped me and he said, I don't suppose you remember me, but he said, I had you in English, 10th grade English. And he said, I'm now he's down at Southeastern Community College. And he said, you know, that the stuff you used to put on the board, he said, that really helped me when I got down there. And I thought, oh, wonderful.
That's a great story.
Yeah.
And I have a similar story. I was teaching 12th grade English, and in one of my classes there was this young man who just kind of sat there with a dull expression on his face, and didn't seem to be really responding to anything I was saying. And his essays were kind of boring and mediocre, but I always made a point of saying something nice about every kid's essay before I then started pointing out ways that maybe they could improve it. I found they listened better if you gave a compliment to start with and then started pointing out things they could do to improve. And but I always thought of him as kind of a dullard. I even told a friend of mine that I thought of him as sort of a vegetable that I needed to pour water on periodically, just to make sure he was alive. You know? And so he graduated and never said anything to me. And about 20 years later, I was going to an antiquarian book fair, where you go from kind of booth to booth with different booksellers from all over the country. And I stopped in this one little stall, and this guy said, Mr. Commons, John, it's John so-and-so. And I looked at him, and I said, oh, my God, it's so good to see you. He said, you know, I've been meaning to write you all these years. Your 12th grade English class changed my life. I went to college, I majored in English, and now I've got an antiquarian bookstore, and I love books and love reading, and it all started with you. And I almost passed out.
Wow, that's
great. You never know when you're a teacher. You're planting seeds, and sometimes you're watering them a little bit, but you don't know what kind of impact you're going to have. So consequently, you treat every kid with respect and affection and encouragement, and generally speaking, it works.
You know, I used to for the essays and the papers and so forth, I would always give points, and, you know, and I always gave so many points for content. Because you know, what they had to say was good, but they had a lot of grammatical errors, spelling errors,
well,
whatever.
Well, that wouldn't have worked for this particular kid because there wasn't any content and there wasn't any But apparently something clicked with him. So.
Good.
Mom, I remember some story, too, about a kid in your class who had a heart problem or something.
Yes. Gosh. Yeah, he did. He had a congenital heart condition, and so he was always late to class. Well, I never counted him absent. I had him in ninth grade. Then I moved to the high school, and he, of course, did too. And the high school was so, you know, strung out, big, yeah, that he was really having a lot of problems. And so I, in my room, which was right across from the office, I had an extra door in the back. I had two doors, and so there were some lockers back there, so I let him put his things in one of those lockers because his locker was God only knows where and so forth. But I don't know. He actually died at the high school at one point.
Sad.
And yeah, it was. It was so sad.
Yeah.
It was so sad. But he had his mother wrote me a note, and he and his family had gone to the Grand Canyon, and he told his mother that he wanted to go to the North Rim because that's where my husband had died.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Well, I hear the tears in your voice, and it's those moments that are poignant and give life its meaning.
That's right.
Yeah. And, Paul, in Confessions of a Headmaster, you did write about some deaths of students and how that impacted you, too.
Yeah, if you're going to be the head of a school, as I was for 22 years and then stay there for another 10 years, it's something that I didn't think about when I first became a headmaster, but I very quickly had to confront it because in my second year, we had a boy whose father made hang gliders and took his son out to hang gliding, and his son hit an air pocket and plummeted to his death. And the father, of course, had to watch this and then sail down and to his son. And then I had to, the father and mother were so devastated they couldn't even think about any kind of a memorial service. So I wound up putting on, you know, in effect, a memorial service for the boy where I had to organize the whole thing and bring in the music and say some words myself. And I found I had to do that several times during my years there and hit upon a way of making it work for families where you told stories, had music, and, you know, created a really nice ceremony so that they could get through it.
Paul, I was also really touched by your first exposure to HIV?
Well, I had two of them that kind of back-to-back that were both quite extraordinary. Some people may remember Elizabeth Glazer. She was the founder of Pediatric AIDS Foundation. And her husband, Paul Michael Glazer, was Starsky in the early TV series, Starsky and Hutch.
Oh, my God.
And Elizabeth, when she had her before her first child, she had some problem where she had to have a blood transfusion. This was before people knew much about it. And she contracted AIDS through a bad needle or bad blood or whatever, and then passed it on to two children, Ariel, her little beautiful little daughter, and her son Jake. Jake is still alive because, as you know, the medicine and the technology has improved so dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
But Ariel, this beautiful little girl, didn't survive. And in those days, AIDS, people didn't know much about it. I knew enough to know that it wasn't contagious. You know, you didn't get it by being in the same room with someone or having them sneeze on you or whatever. So when Elizabeth first came to see me to get her kid in kindergarten, she told me this story, and I said, well, of course you'd be welcome here. And I went over and put my arms around her, and she was just sobbing. And I said, what's going on? She said, this is the third school I've been to. The other two told me they couldn't take my child because of the AIDS. So it was a nice moment, and I'm actually glad that I responded that way, which was kind of a natural response, I think. And then I had a wonderful, wonderful teacher who came to see me one day to tell me that he had discovered he was HIV positive, and then he also told me at the time that he was gay, so we decided we'd live with it as long as we could. But then when the spots started showing, we had to go to the full faculty, tell them, and everybody loved him. He had an incredible sense of humor. He was a great classroom teacher, and by the way, he was one of these great teachers at the middle school. Middle school kids just adored Steve. And so when we knew that we had to tell the entire community, we did something that I think was really quite wonderful. I lured him over to the school because now he was quite sick. And we put him in he didn't know what was going on. We put him in a convertible in front of the school and then drove him around the back of the school where we had the entire student body lined up on either side of a driveway. And when we turned the corner and drove, and he was in a convertible in the back seat, we had the whole student body standing and cheering him, and we drove him up to a building that we had put his name on it, and to this day it's called the Stephen Morgan Middle School building. And it was quite a moment. It was one of those,
I guess. Oh, that's wonderful.
Never forget.
That's wonderful.
And Steve, to put a postscript on the story, had a friend of his drive him back that evening because he wanted to take a picture of the building with his name on it and send it to his mother.
Aww.
Yeah.
Which he did.
Yeah. I'm wondering about the dropout rates. They must be more in the less advantaged schools. Am I right?
Oh, of course. In a Crossroads, virtually, and every private school I know, virtually has no dropouts. I mean, if you take Crossroads admits, I won't even give you the number, but let's just take the ninth grade. Crossroads has 125 ninth graders.
Uh-huh.
4 years later, virtually, they have the same 125 ninth graders, and 125 of them virtually every year go to college.
Wow.
And I think
you go across town to some of these inner city schools, and they'll start with a ninth grade of whatever, 400 kids, and by the time they're seniors, there's like 200 of them, and less than 20% of them will not only graduate, but will graduate and go on to college. So it's a huge dropout rate between ninth grade and 12th grade, and it's a very low percentage of kids who will go to four-year colleges after that. So again, this is this sort of built-in unfairness in our society. If you're born in a certain place and go to certain schools, your life is pretty, it's not to say that you're not going to have emotional difficulties in your life. Everybody does. But at least you don't have to worry about your education.
Mm-hmm. I think I read somewhere in your book where you talked to a teacher who started a school year with 30 kids and by March had 30, still had 30 kids.
This was a public school down in a low-income neighborhood of Los Angeles. The turn, I mean, that was an aberration that year, but it did in fact happen because it was the school, they were using it as sort of a dumping ground for homeless children in a shelter nearby and for immigrant children who they didn't know where to place them. So they were dumping all these kids into this one school, and the turnover rate was just astonishing.
So by March, she had 30 completely different kids.
I mean, how do you teach in conditions like that?
I can't imagine.
I can't imagine either. I mean, I can imagine that it's impossible. That's
Sure. No continuity. Oh, gosh.
Yep.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Paul F. Cummins, author of Confessions of a Headmaster. Now, you've written several other books. Do you want to talk a little bit about those?
Sure. Well, we were talking a little bit before about the the disparity of wealth in this country. So my previous book on education, the one before Confessions, was and also published by Red Hand Press, was entitled Two Americas, Two Educations.
Mm.
And then the subtitle was Funding Quality Schools for All Children. So I get into some of the things that we were talking about earlier about the how in certain schools you get everything and certain schools you don't, and that's the first third of the book, and then the second two thirds is where I get fairly political and talk about where I think the money could come from, but I don't know if you want me to get into that now. So I'll just say that it's there, and if anybody wants to see a vision of how I think we could fund public schools. It's in the second two-thirds of Two Americas, Two Educations. Before that, I wrote a book entitled Proceed with Passion, and that book is kind of my philosophy of education, and I think it's a pretty good book. So there's those. I wrote a biography years ago about a Holocaust survivor, a man who became kind of a mentor in my life. He was a Viennese Jewish intellectual, conductor of symphony orchestras, who got picked up when the Germans invaded Austria and set off to Dachau, where he did a couple astonishing things there. He created a secret orchestra that played in the latrines on Sunday afternoons when the Nazi guards kind of left them alone for a couple hours.
Oh my gosh!
And then he was he also wrote a song called the Dachau Lied, which kind of jumped from prison camp to prison camp and became a well-known World War II Holocaust survivor song.
Oh, wow.
And he was transferred from Dachau to Buchenwald, and from there, it's a bizarre story. He was released through a series of unbelievable lucky events, and wound up back in Paris, wired his lady friend that he was still alive, and she said, she was teaching in the Philippines, and she said, well, get over here. The conductor just dropped dead, and I'm going to get you the job. he went down to southern Italy, took a freighter from Italy to the Philippines, and a couple of months later, he's conducting again. So 3 months earlier, he's a prisoner fighting for his life in Buchenwald because of the horrible conditions there. 3 months later, he's conducting in the Philippines. And then a year later, the Japanese invade and put him in a prison camp.
Oh,
and then let him out on the promise that he will put the orchestra back together again, which he didn't do. He lied to them and then eventually kind of disappeared into the city. And then came to America. It's a long story, but anyway, I wrote a biography on his life and the impact that he had on my life entitled Dachau Song. So the song he wrote in Dachau was, the German is Dachau Lied, L-I-E-D, meaning song, but for English I call it Dachau Song. And I think it's a quite wonderful book about an extraordinary man.
And his name is?
His name was Herbert Zipper, Z-I-P-P-E-R, and that book was published by Peter Lang Publications, but the remaining copies of the book are now available through a school called the Colburn School, C-O-L-B-U-R-N, in Southern California, and there are a few copies that are still available there, and I have a few copies. So, again, someone could contact my organization if they were keenly interested in this, and we'd make the book available to them.
Wow.
And then, as I think you or someone mentioned in my bio, I've written two volumes of poetry that have been published
yes.
by small presses.
Yes.
And two children's books.
And two children's books, which are also, again, available here. One of them, I think, is actually quite wonderful, and we're going to try and see if a major publisher might pick it up. It's called All Aboard the Train of Thought. And it's kind of like, it's kind of like an Alice in Wonderland, Phantom Tollbooth journey through a poetry world. And it's just kind of a wonderful little adventure, and you learn a fair amount about what poetry is all about by reading the book.
So, Paul, what made you decide you wanted to write and publish books in the middle of opening schools?
It seemed kind of like if you have something to say and you love writing yourself, then you find yourself starting to write. I wrote my doctoral dissertation on a poet named Richard Wilbur, and I found myself trying to emulate him and write poems kind of like him, and then I just started writing myself.
With your first published
and
book,
with my books on education, I guess it's because if you believe in something, then you want to try and convince other people that what you believe in is important.
And when was the first book published?
Oh gosh, I don't remember. I don't remember.
That's okay. I'm just wondering, in terms of finding a publisher, was it hard for you at that time?
Well, I lucked out and found a couple publishers that were interested through a friend of mine. I'm interested in what I'd written.
Oh, it does seem like some people either just sort of fall into getting published really easily, and other people really struggle.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a struggle these days. Yeah, unfortunately, yeah. I've developed a relationship with this wonderful small press out here that likes my work, and so I've kind of stayed with them for the last three books. They didn't publish my poetry. They published my books on education. And the poetry books are just kind of hit and miss. You send them out, and maybe the editor likes the kind of stuff you write, and maybe not, because the kind of poetry I write is a little bit more accessible than what is sort of in vogue. So
accessible is good.
Yeah, accessible is very good.
An editor that isn't sort of prejudiced against that. I mean, I don't know if you read the poetry in the New Yorker, which I do. I subscribe to it. I read it. And I'll be damned if I can understand 9 out of the 10 poems that they publish in issue after issue. And it seems to me that they're so personal to the author that they're really hard for readers to understand what the hell they're talking about.
One of the areas of poetry that I'm finding really fascinating is spoken word.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
I just listened to...
I take spoken word... DVDs around with me. I have to drive all over town going to meetings, and I'm constantly listening to spoken word.
There was one that I think won a fairly prestigious contest called Black Privilege, the name of the poem. If you haven't heard that, I'd check that out on YouTube.
Do you remember the name of the author?
Not off the top of my head. It was...
Okay, well, I'll look at it. It's probably online. That's the name of the poem, right?
Yeah, Black Privilege on YouTube. If you Google Black Privilege poem, you'll get it.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Well, good. Thank you.
And then I was also listening to one this morning, these three girls who were on Queen Latifah's show.
Uh-huh.
And they did this poem about education. And it starts out something like, somewhere in America... there's a child with a copy of Catcher in the Rye and a child with a gun, and only one of them is illegal. And it's not...
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's what a wonderful line. And it happens to be true.
I know. That's the sad part.
It's funny you mentioned Catcher in the Rye, because when I first got to Stanford, I went up a little bit early to register early because I was going to play freshman football, I thought. Well, I did play for 3 weeks until I got injured, but immediately I discovered this was not what I should be doing. The competition was so different than what I was used to in high school. It was just, it was a disaster for me. But in any event, I'm up there registering early, and I'm standing in line, and this young guy that I mentioned earlier, this fellow student, said to me, he said, so what are you reading right now? And I looked at him, I said, what do you mean reading? Classes haven't started. I mean, I had just met him. And he looked at me with this kind of furrowed brow as if to say, geez, what kind of idiots is Stanford admitting these days? This guy thinks you can't read a book unless it's assigned to you. And so after we registered, I kind of forgot about him, and I was walking back to my dorm, and this guy walks up to me, grabs me by the arm, and says, come with me, I'm going to do you a favor. And I was so shocked, I went with him. And he walked me over to the bookstore and bought a copy of Animal Farm of George Orwell.
Ah.
I said, go home and read this. I'll come over tomorrow, and we'll talk about it. And I was shocked. I did. And I kind of liked it. I didn't really understand it very well. I didn't know anything about Russian history, but he explained it to me. And then he handed me another book, and he said, read this now, and I'll come over in 2 days. It's a little bit longer. And it was Catcher in the Rye.
Oh.
So it's one of the first two books that I read at Stanford, and I got excited about it. He came over. We talked about it. We talked about teenage alienation, and we talked about, you know, all the various episodes in the book, and I started getting really interested in reading. And then he gave me a third book, just to finish the story, which was George Orwell's 1984. Mm-hmm. He said, but you're going to need 3 days to read this one.
Yeah.
Which I did, and then we talked about it. It was a terrifying book.
Wow. Now, is that person still someone you're connected to?
No. The sad part of it was that we became really good friends. And in my this was freshman year. In my sophomore year, we were taking a class together, and so I went over to his dorm room one morning to walk to class with him, and he was packing his suitcase. And I said, John, what are you doing? And he said, I can't stand this place. It's boring. The students here. He said, no offense to you. He said, but the students are really dumb, and I just don't like it here. He was a brilliant guy. So he said, I'm going to travel around the world. So he went home, hitchhiked to New Orleans, got a job working on a freighter, and traveled all around the world. And I didn't hear from him until the end of my junior year. I got a postcard from him, and it was from the island of Bali. And then I didn't hear from him again. I didn't know where to write him. There was no return address. And then at the very last 2 weeks of my my 4 years at Stanford, he showed up one day where I was living, and I was sitting on the front steps, and I saw him walking up the sidewalk, and we went out to dinner and chatted and talked and everything, and I had a motorcycle at the time, and so we went for a motorcycle ride and so on. He had a motorcycle, and he said he didn't know what he was going to do, so he thought he would go to the Army Language School in Monterey and get his Army service over, because he was afraid he was going to get drafted, and God knows where he would get sent. So I went off to Harvard Graduate School, and he went off to Monterey. And in the fall of my first year at Harvard Graduate School, I was over having dinner with a mutual friend, and another friend who had been to Stanford dropped by, and he had known John too, and I said, oh, have you seen John lately? And he looked at me with this ashen look, and he said, you haven't heard? And I said, heard what? He said, John was killed last summer. I said, what? He apparently went off a cliff in Monterey on his motorcycle.
Oh.
And I never knew whether it was he was depressed when I talked to him. I never knew whether it was an accident or whether he decided he just didn't want to live anymore. But I'm able to tell the story now without completely puddling up, but sometimes when I tell the story, I do find tears coming into my eyes, because John changed my life.
Absolutely.
In a big, big way.
Wow.
What a waste.
A friend of mine who's a shrink said, well, you know, Paul, you know, given all the wonderful things in education you've done that John would have so valued, maybe that was his purpose.
Hmm. Well,
who knows? Yeah.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Paul F. Cummins, author of Confessions of a Headmaster. Paul, we only have about 7 minutes left, I think. And I wanted to talk a little bit about From the very beginning with the Crossroads School, which was the first school that you co-founded, you put a lot of emphasis on the arts, and that was not common then and is probably even less common in a sense now in public schools. Can you talk a little bit about why you made that decision and how, what support you got for it?
Sure. Well, there weren't any arts in my high school, and then I went back to teach at my old high school, and there weren't any arts. And I actually made a suggestion to the headmaster that we form a curriculum committee to look on how we might bring the arts into the school. And he got furious with me for suggesting that maybe he didn't know how to run the school, and he fired me.
Oh, for heaven's sake!
But which is fine, because I'd probably still be teaching English there if that happened. But what I discovered in looking at my own life and looking at the lives of other kids is a couple things. One, we all have many, many different talents, and the schools tend to reward only a couple of those talents. Mm-hmm. Howard Gardner, who's a big name in education theory these days, wrote a book called Multiple Intelligences, where he talks about that there are seven different kinds of intelligence. And two of the obvious ones are language skills and math skills. But he includes as a separate form of intelligence music, visual and spatial knowledge and intelligence, kinetic, kinesthetic, which includes not only physical education, but dance and so on. Mm-hmm. And then he includes self-awareness and awareness of other people. But it occurred to me early on that kids who have certain talents, the schools don't allow them to express themselves. And so the schools wind up evaluating the kids on what they can't do and ignoring what they can do. And so I think that's still built into many of our schools. And so that seems to me wrong. Number two, it seems to me that self-expression is a fundamental human need. And kids are going to do it. They're going to express themselves, and they're either going to do it in positive channels or they're going to do it in negative channels. And when you bring the arts into low-income schools, many kids flourish who otherwise have been just floundering and suffering and angry and dropping out. I've had a program for 14 years now in a boys' incarceration facility where we bring the arts to boys who are locked up for after school. They have to go to classes while they're in camp, and they're generally speaking not too terrific. But then we bring them classes in photography and filmmaking and rap poetry writing and journalism and so on, and they fall in love with it. And so you take kids who have been doing poor in English and allow them to write the kind of things that they really do know how to write, and they start getting excited about learning. So I think that self-expression is a fundamental human need, and the arts are a wonderful way to allow that positive self-expression to happen.
You know, it's interesting, as there's been all this emphasis on the reading, writing, arithmetic, and de-emphasis on arts in the schools, and it's a waste of time and so forth. When you look at back over the span of human existence, what do we remember most about any time and place? It's the artwork it produced, the artwork and the literature. You know, that's it's not how much money people made.
I'm blanking on who the quote, but you know, when all the ruins of civilization are sifted away, what's left are the arts.
Yeah. And they last for thousands of years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's what's one of the things I
find. It's a huge mistake we make in our public schools. Whenever there's a budget cut or financial crises, we delete the things that engage kids. And that's kind of what my new book is about. I believe, you know, the schools talk about the five solids, English, history, math, science, foreign language. And I talk about what I call the five other solids, which are the arts, human development, physical education, environmental education, and community action, community activism, and social community service for kids. And those five things, what they have in common is that they are hands-on, experiential, project-based, and they engage kids. And that's what we cut out. And then we wonder why kids are dropping out. Well, what, a dropout is just another word for disengaged.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
Mom, what's your? You have a favorite movie line that, remember Peggy Sue Got Married?
Oh, yeah. You know that, that, if you haven't ever seen that movie, you have to see Peggy Sue Got
What's
Married.
What's the line?
The line, go ahead.
Yeah, the line is, okay, she comes back in time, and she goes back in time to her algebra class. And she takes the test, and she doesn't do anything. She doesn't write anything. And the teacher said, "We didn't write anything." And she said, "Well, I happen to know that in later life, I will never use algebra."
Well, you know, there's a really good point there, because we defeat so many kids by Algebra 1, by Geometry, by Algebra 2, who aren't ever going to use it in their lives, and who have other talents that are completely ignored.
Yeah.
That's why I say we so often measure kids for what they can't do, of what they can't do, and we completely ignore what they can do.
That's right. Well, I thought, being a musician, I thought it was just fantastic that you insisted that music be a big part of developing a curriculum.
That probably comes from being married to a musician as well.
Yeah, probably does, yeah.
But I do adore music and think it's important in everybody's lives, and I'm still taking piano, still struggling away at taking piano lessons myself.
Well, good for you.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, we're about out of time.
This has been lovely, lovely
well,
talking to you.
Well, it's been a delight talking to you. Boy, that time went fast.
It sure did.
It really did. So if you just tuned in, we've been talking with Paul Cummins, author of Confessions of a Headmaster. And, of course, the book's available on Amazon, I believe, and
it's available on Amazon. It's also available redhen.org, R-E-D-H-E-N. That's the name of the press, .org.
Very good. Very good. And so thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for including me. It's been it's been a treat talking to both of you.
And Caroline, do you have a closing quote for us today?
I do, and this is actually from, he has a quote over before every chapter, and this one is from Mark Twain, who is one of my favorites. 20 years from now, you will be more disappointed by the things you didn't do than by the ones you did do. So throw off the bowlines, sail away from the safe harbor, catch the trade winds in your sails, and explore, dream, discover.
And if you missed part of this interview, want to hear the rest, we'll have it up on writersvoices.com in about a week. We're also rebroadcasting Monday morning, 8 a.m. on KRUU 100.1 FM in Fairfield, and KRUUFM.com for live stream if you're outside of Fairfield. And we'll see you next week on Writers Voices.
Thank you again. Bye.
Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUU-LP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.